Hey everyone, this is episode number 73 of the Bacon, Bibles, and Barbells podcast. Bacon for your heart, Bibles for your soul, and barbells for your body. This is a really exciting episode, you guys. We have Greg Knuckles, the founder of multiple strength sites, and currently he works on his site called StrongerByScience.com. He is a huge fan. I'm a huge fan of him. He's not a huge fan of me. I'm a huge fan of him. And I know Everett is as well. And so we're really, really excited to be able to interview him in a few minutes. But before we do, let's talk about our super awesome sponsor at ValleyVintageShop.com. In the fitness community, as we figure out our health and how the body works, most of us strive to use as many natural products as possible. So I'm really excited to begin sponsoring the BBB podcast with the Valley Vintage Shop. They have all-natural soap bars, delicious beard balms, oils, mustache waxes, luscious locks, hair serums and balms, lip balms, and more being added all the time. Each product is handcrafted and no fake fragrances or dyes are used. The pumice soap is great for sanding down the calluses that you can get when you're lifting. Beard balm is great for sanding down the calluses in your beard. And it's also amazing beard food. I added that part about sanding down that beard, sorry. So many great items to choose from. 10% off all products with the code GAINSGRACE. That's one word, GAINS with a Z, GAINSGRACE. You can find all of this at ValleyVintageShop.com. Again, that's 10% off. Gains Grace is the code at ValleyVintageShop.com. And that's 10% off code. Use the coupon code Gains Grace. Gains with a Z. Grace, get 10% off all your awesome needs. We have a pretty good amount of humidity around here, so I've never had to use lip balm. But if you did live in the Arizona, New Mexico, or Colorado area, lip balm might be your thing. So check them out, ValleyVintageShop.com. Everett, how's your week going?
Man, my week is it's going all right. You know, I'm getting ready for this meet. It's coming up on the 18th, yeah. So I'm not quite at my 10-day countdown, but I'm getting close.
Wow.
And I'm really excited about it. My hope is to to get a high enough total to give me a class 2. You know, we've been talking in the group about the RTS, you know, the Russian classification system, which should put us on some NSA watch list. But if we're not already, but anyway, in my weight, I'm tracking right around 237 or so. The class 2 will be 605 kilograms, which is about 1,331 pounds, I think. And that's kind of my, I think that's going to be my goal. Now, I don't know if I'm going to reach it, but it's going to be my goal. On my third attempts, that's what I'm going to shoot for. Other than that, I mean, everything's kind of coming together. You know, I'm really excited to talk to Greg because, you know, I'm still working through this adductor issue. And I'm still, you know, so I've narrowed my squat stance a bit and it's putting a little strain on my lower back. And so I'm feeling that. I'm trying to, you know, to stretch that out on a regular basis. But then also, you know, my ego gets the better of me. And so I was in the gym this last Saturday doing deadlifts. And of course, you know, the regular me says just deadlift up to a reasonable, you know, 500 pounds. And then the inner me says, you know, and do it 3 times. you know, so I hit it for 3 reps, but, and I could tell that it was a bit of a strain. So I think that my lower back is just a little tender from that. So I'm trying to take it easy, you know, still working my pause benches, everything, but everything's coming together and I'm really excited, to do this meet coming up. How about you? How's your week been?
It's going really, really good. We were at the Arnold Classic. We can talk about that, I guess, briefly. We recorded our last episode, I want to say, Tuesday as usual. But I flew out Thursday night, so I had to put the episodes up early and, I was talking to my coach. So the way he programs it, and this is something I'm new to the world of strength programming. and so he explains that for all of his lifters, he gives them a 90-day cycle up to their meet. And so he gave me the program. And it's really interesting. It's a lot of squatting and benching, not as much deadlifting as I'm used to. So we're going to be doing a lot more squats, a lot more bench. He we're really working on just trying to build up to a peak. And the nice thing about it that I've seen so far is that I'm working around an 8 RPE. So I'm never actually getting near failure. I'm working in a good area where it's a lot of growth, a lot of building up. We're not actually testing the one rep max. He told me that he's going to run this for a month and he'll probably adjust and change it depending on how I work. But as far as building, I guess hitting PRs in this program, it would be, for example, the opening workout for each one of the opening exercise for each one of the workouts is, today I had comp bench, competition bench, and you do a set of three at 8. And so you do a pretty decent weight, you know, comp bench, and then you take 77% of your one rep max and you do sets of 5 until you hit an 8 RPE. If that makes sense. And it should take between 4 and 6 reps. I mean, 4 and 6 sets to hit.
And our RPE is the rate of perceived exertion, right?
Yes.
So that's how much. Now, how do you, just briefly, like, how do you know what an 8 feels like?
So an eight would feel like you might be able to do 2 more. You might be able to hit 2 more reps and you're done. And so that's an 8. A 7, you might be able to hit 3 more. A 6, you might be able to hit 4 more in your set. Now, and so instead of having to, like, say, okay, I want you to do 70% of your one rep max for 6, you know, and of course your one rep max, you set that who knows how many weeks ago. And, you know, so the numbers are going to be off. You may have a good day, you may have a bad day, but it doesn't matter. You're going to be doing this number at 6, 70% of your one rep max. That's how a lot of programs work. The way auto-regulation works, it's based on how you're feeling that day. So if I'm having a really crappy day, didn't sleep well, my RPE of 8 might be lower today than it was last week when I did the exact same workout. So it's based on how I'm feeling, how everything's going, and it's all built around that I will progress. The progression will happen, but it'll potentially limit risk of injury and he said, which is interesting. He said, you'll feel PRs happen, but it's not going to be a PR of how much weight you put on the bar. It's going to be more of a PR of how many sets does it take you to get to that 8 RPE, right?
Okay.
If you could visualize that. So I know I'm getting really strong. If 2 weeks ago, man, 3 sets and I was at 8, and now I'm doing 5, 6 sets and I'm still not hitting 8 at that weight. So my one max would go.
Your one rep max goes up, but also you're handling more volume, and that's kind of one of the things that's sort of making you strong. And that makes sense. Now, the thing you have to be careful with, I assume, is it's so easy, you know, being lifters, for our ego to step in and go, oh yeah, no, I totally could have gotten 2 more, even though you maybe couldn't have. I mean, you might be at a 9.5, but because your ego steps in, you might come across as though you could do more.
Yeah, and that's something that Mike Tuchscher, the founder of RTS Training, who also developed this protocol, said that new lifters, their RPEs are going to be, the RPE is going to be wrong for a long time, and that's just the way it is. And you got to be really careful of it. And so, sometimes, and I might start doing this in the group. I might just start posting videos and like, hey, listen, I think that was an 8. What do you guys think? And I might just post that. I'd be like, am I off on this? Could I, you know, what does it look like? And sort of a form check, also an exertion check. But today I did, it was bench, started with comp bench. I did 295 for 3 reps. Felt a little heavy. And I might have not warmed up enough. And then I had to do, up to 8 with 260. So I did 5 sets of 5 with 260 and really trying to focus. I posted a video in the group, and I think you might have mentioned that it looks like there might have been a slight dip. And so really just trying to focus on being really explosive I hold it and then boom. And so that pop, the weight feels really, it feels light. It really does feel really light. The distance, getting the movement all the way up to where I'm locked out, feels really short. And so I'm really just trying to focus on the setup, trying to focus on how long it takes me to set up, There's, I believe, a minute when they say the bar is loaded. You have 60 seconds to get
start the lift.
And so I can't be, you know, sort of trying to get my shoulder blades tight and then trying to twist the bar around to feel it. I don't know. You know, I'm trying to figure out how can I get set up and moving where I know I set up correctly and I did it in a timely manner. That's one thing I saw in the Arnold. We had one guy timed out. Well, we had two guys I saw time out. One of them was their equipment was touching the bars. One of the rules is apparently your wrist straps can't touch the bar, and so she had to adjust it, the wrist straps. And of course, I mean, that's something
you have to go into the back. You can't adjust your wrist straps right there. Yeah.
And she ran out of time. And
sure.
And then another guy asked them to move the bar to the left because they were doing so many deadlifts, they were putting a dent in the floor, and it was making them deadlift in a hole. And so they moved the bar. But then the time ran out, and of course, it was frustrating because they should have reset the – I don't know if they should have reset the time. But it's one of those things where they said bar is loaded after they moved the bar. And so it was like, well, you said bar is loaded, but you only had 20 seconds to start the pull. So they let him –
yeah, you've got to get the start command, yeah.
They let him re-pull. They gave him another shot. But it was one of those things where it was interesting getting to see all the different lifts, and I really focused – on watching the squats and the sumos. I'm feeling really strong as far as the training's going, and but I'm really excited about. So we got Greg on the show. I said a few episodes ago, I ran into him through a friend who knew that he lives in Raleigh, and I'm about half hour south, you know, and so I got to get some tips on my squat, and he showed me that I was making basically throwing a number up that I couldn't do, and it was not a legitimate number. It was something that I told myself mentally, I can't do this. This is heavy. This is going to destroy me. And so for months, I was stuck at a number that I do all the time now. I mean, I did 315 for sets of three easily enough. And he basically said, we're going to go past 315 to where I think you're actually going to start seeing what failure feels and looks like on the squat. And I got to 365. And just for me, that mental wall was removed. And you know, so I'm really excited to have him on the show. We're really, really, really excited to have him on. And I hope you guys really enjoy it. He'll get in some of the weeds with some of the stuff, but that's honestly, isn't that what you want? I think that's what we need. We need better,
that's right,
deeper content. Like you're getting more than your money's worth with this episode.
Shoot down all of our bro science. That's right.
Anyways, all right. Well, let's get Greg on the show. Here he is. We are joined with Greg Knuckles. Well, I know him from Strength Theory, Power Pastor. You know him from. What was it called you were talking about earlier?
Yeah, this is a social media based fitness group or software called Fitocracy website. And I was on it several years ago. Greg and I crossed paths there and got a lot of good information from him there. So that's why I first kind of ran into him and started following him back before he was super popular on the interwebs. And now, of course, he's just the man. So,
yeah. I first heard about him through I'm not going to say he's obscure, but through a free audiobook called Muscle for Life by a bodybuilder, Mike Matthews. And he mentions, I believe, Greg, you might have posted a few articles on his site, Muscle for Life. And that's where I first found out about you. And then Everett here is the one who got me into powerlifting. And we're constantly spamming your site on our Facebook group. But we're really, really glad to have you on the show, Greg. And if you don't mind, just for listeners, giving a quick, I guess, bio of who you are, like as far as powerlifting is concerned and strength training and I guess the science and research stuff. What got you into all of that?
Well, first off, thanks for having me, guys. So my name is Greg Knuckles. I'm a powerlifter and coach, and I occasionally write about picking up heavy things. What got me into lifting was basically I wanted to become a better athlete. I played basketball, football, baseball. Of the three, and you'd never guess it from looking at me now, but of the three, my best was basketball. This is just a completely different world now. But what got me into lifting actually is my freshman year of high school. So I'm about 5'10". I was around 160 then, and I could dunk off of like a perfect alley-oop, but I have really small hands. And so I couldn't get high enough to throw down with two hands. And I just wanted to get stronger so I could jump higher to dunk once in a game. That was like literally my only training goal when I got into lifting. Basically from concussions, from MCL tear, from some pretty bad ankle issues, I just got too injured to play competitive team sports anymore. And it turned out to be a blessing in disguise because I'm better at lifting weights than I was at basketball. That's what got me into the sport. I needed an outlet for my competitive drive, and powerlifting gave that to me once I couldn't play sports anymore. What got me into writing and the online stuff, that was also a happy accident. My wife got a really, really good journalism internship coming out of college, and that was in Orange County, California. And I had a job lined up at a gym in North Carolina. And obviously, that's not a tenable commute. So her opportunity coming out of college was much better than mine was. Mm-hmm. Like it was the number one journalism internship in the country. So we were like, okay, we're going to California. And I was lucky because Lindsay had convinced me to start a blog, like a year and a half before that. Basically because I used to talk her ear off about lifting all the time. And she was like, hey, so this is cool and whatnot, but how about you write it down so you can talk with people who actually do want to talk about this stuff all the time? I never planned on, you know, making it big or turning it into a business or anything like that. I'd started blogging, had gained a small following, I guess. And then when we moved out to California, I didn't have a job out there. I worked as the content manager for Juggernaut Fitness Systems, but I didn't have like, you know, full-time employment or anything. So I was like, oh, okay, well, let me see if I can start taking this blogging thing more seriously. Cause she was only guaranteed, I think, 16 weeks up front, and you can't really get a job in a gym, with that sort of knowledge. Like you can't get clients and be like, hey, so I might take off on you in 3 months, but you should work with me now anyways. That ended up being a very happy accident as well. And that's kind of my backstory with getting into powerlifting and getting into what I do now.
Nice. Now you you have a couple of records, right?
Not anymore. I mean,
not like, anymore. Well, so what are your best lifts in competition?
My best lifts in competition are a 750 squat. I actually do not remember what I benched at my last meet. It was either 205 or 210 kilos.
Okay.
So that would be either 551 or not 551, sorry, 451. Or 463, one of the two. And my best deadlift in competition is 710.
Okay.
Great. When you're with the different sites, and I'm kind of going off the outline here, sorry, but with the different sites, you've been able to reach out and connect with other shows. I mean, I know Juggernaut Training Systems has had you on. You've connected with other sites. Do you find with, I guess, the network, the different voices, the different personalities on the internet that you have to reach out, or they generally find you and reach out after you?
So more often than not, they reach out to me. With Juggernaut, that was me reaching out to them. But yeah, I don't know. I'm kind of shy, at least online. So yeah, I don't, I'm not the best networker in the world. and honestly, like, part of that is just, I don't really pay all that much attention to what other people are doing. And that may sound bad, but I'm still young. I'm 25, but I've been in powerlifting for 12 years now. I've been reading the content out there on the internet, basically from the time I got into the sport. And it really is true that there's nothing new under the sun. So I reached a point maybe like 3 years ago when I'd just been like voraciously reading online lifting content for like 8 or 9 years at that point. And I realized that like 95% of the stuff I took the time to read was stuff that I'd already heard before half a dozen times. So just like the ROI was pretty low for continuing to keep up with kind of like the online lifting like content scene. So honestly, like, I don't even know who I would reach out to network with. Most of the time I spend like reading and educating myself now is just from reading research. So yeah, I don't spend as much time and energy on like keeping up with the fitness community and reaching out to people and networking as I should. So more often than not, if I do a guest post somewhere, come on a podcast, it's because someone reached out to me.
Nice. Now, what is the area of your research?
Just anything related to getting stronger.
Okay. And that's a pretty broad area. What would you say, like, I guess the next question on this, on my outline here, as far as injuries are concerned, what would you say the most common injury for powerlifters are, and the reason for these injuries? What would you say that would be?
So I actually have data on that I haven't analyzed yet. So if I got around to analyzing that, I could give you an objective answer. But as it is, I'll just kind of go off of what I've seen. It seems like probably the two most common issues I see are shoulder issues and low back issues. And they can both come from poor technique, but honestly, I think they just kind of go hand in hand with the sport. If you're squatting heavy, deadlifting heavy, you're putting a lot of strain on your lower back. If you're benching heavy fairly frequently, like, that's putting a lot of strain on your shoulder. And I think powerlifters on the whole tend to not do quite enough like prehab or rehab work, just to make sure that everything stays healthy and functioning. But at the same time, like, it is a sport. You're training hard for it. And sports have inherent risk. So, for example, this may not apply to many people listening to this show, but you can look at someone like Ed Cohn. Like, he had absolutely impeccable, flawless technique. But he's already had to get one hip replaced. And I think either he just got a second hip replaced or he's going to soon. And he's still relatively young, or at least by like hip replacement standards.
Yeah.
But it's just, you know, if you're Ed Cohn and you're squatting 800-900 pounds in training year in and year out for a decade, stuff breaks down. So yeah, I think some of it's attributable to poor technique. I think some of it's attributable to lack of rehab, prehab work, but also, I mean, you're picking up heavy stuff all the time in the same basic motor pattern. So that's just going to cause wear and tear.
No, that makes sense. That makes sense. And so when you're constantly putting your back or your legs or your shoulder in various positions, then it causes more issues or more likely to have issues. One of the things that I've been trying to sort of sort out with myself, and we'll come to my problems because you're going to help me, I hope. But One of the things I've been trying to sort out is really what I do with my body the rest of the day. You know, I'm a desk jockey as a pastor. I try to sleep as much as possible. But I've noticed that most of my injuries have related to kind of some repetitive motions that I do all day long. So it's, you know, I have tendonitis in one arm, and I've noticed that I tend to lean on that arm across my computer for hours at a time, and begin to realize kind of the tension I put on my elbow that way. And I mean, just things like that. So, I mean, are there any kinds of things that you've looked into as far as how to, how to make it, let me see if I can say what I want to say, how to keep yourself from getting more sort of messed up based on some of your daily activities.
I mean, with anything like that, I'm kind of the opinion that stuff that's going to happen happens, and then people kind of look for a way to rationalize it after the fact.
Okay.
So, you know, there's no way to prove that, like, leaning on that elbow is what caused your tendonitis. But then you get tendonitis, something starts hurting, and then you start looking for, hey, what could maybe explain this? So it's kind of like after the fact type reasoning.
Yeah.
But in terms of studies, like prospective studies, where they'll look at characteristics of a population and then look to see what of those characteristics are predictive of injury risk, there aren't many.
Interesting. Well, that's interesting, because, you know, a lot of what's out there is just, you know, conjecture and speculation, right?
Yeah. So something that is relatively predictive of injury risk in terms of like tendonitis or muscle strains is eccentric strength, and specifically having a reserve of eccentric strength. So just if you look at a completely untrained person and look at the amount of force they can produce eccentrically versus concentrically, they can lower, kind of under control, maybe 20-30% more weight than they can actually lift. But training adaptations are specific to the demands placed on a tissue. So if all of your training, you're using the same load for both the eccentric and concentric, which everyone does, unless you're using like weight releasers pretty frequently in your training or something like that, that gap between your eccentric and concentric strength is going to get smaller, and that could potentially increase injury risk. So, for example, if say you have biceps tendonitis, something you could try to maybe not fix the issue, but once some of that pain and inflammation has gone down, something you could do to help prevent that potentially from happening in the future is, say, like one of two options. So if you don't have a partner, what you could do is eccentric bicep curls, where say you get on like a preacher bench and are using a weight for, you know, maybe like 90% of your concentric one rep max. So something that you could probably only do for maybe like 3 or 4 reps, doing like full reps and just doing eccentric only reps. So you control it on the way down and then use your other arm to help bring it back up.
Okay.
And maybe like sets of 10 to 12 that way. And then progressing in load that way over time to build eccentric strength. So that's something that could help prevent injuries a little bit. But yeah, for the most part, and the other thing that's relatively predictive of injury risk is what's called acute on chronic training load. So that's just, it's a fancy way in research of saying if you do too much too soon, your injury risk goes up pretty dramatically. So what most studies find is that increasing either weekly or monthly training volume by more than about 10% starts increasing injury risk.
Okay.
So if you go from like a relatively low volume program to a relatively high volume program just overnight, and that's something I see pretty frequently with a lot of powerlifters. So they'll be healthy going into a meet. They'll compete. Everything's going well. Off-season training starts. They're trying to build some muscle. And, you know, they jump right into training volume that's 4 times higher than whatever they were handling during their peaking block. And then, you know, loads are lower. So they're not, most people just kind of assume that injury risk is inherently higher with heavier loads, which I'm not so confident about. But yeah, they training volume's way up, loads are down, so they're not really worrying about injury. And then lo and behold, they come up with bicep tendonitis or shoulder pain or something like that. Just because they weren't paying attention to acute on chronic training load, and just simply their body and those tissues weren't ready to handle that kind of training volume yet, but they threw that kind of training volume at themselves anyways.
Interesting.
Those are both pretty basic things. So don't jack your volume up like overnight, and make sure you have some sort of eccentric reserve strength. But
you're saying that we shouldn't just turn around and jump on Smolov right after we finish, you know, doing, you know, like a one rep max or something like that.
Yeah, probably not. And okay. So, and another thing to keep in mind, which if people listen to this show and they kind of have some pushback at that and say like, oh, I was doing, I don't know, something fairly low volume, maybe like 5-3-1, and I tried Smolov and I didn't get hurt. So something you need to keep in mind with that is we're talking relative injury risk here. And when you compare powerlifting or really any strength sport to say like literally any team sport on the planet. So, you know, basketball, football, actually not literally any team sport. So baseball has a pretty low injury risk, but regardless. So the typical injury rate you're looking at with most strength sports is something like 2 to 5 injuries per 1,000 hours of training. And to put that in context, that's pretty similar to training for a triathlon and lower than training for like a middle distance or long distance running event, considerably lower than basketball, considerably lower than football. So strength training itself is a relatively safe endeavor as far as injury risk goes. So when I'm talking about these things increasing injury risk, you're moving from low injury risk to just kind of low injury risk. So more often than not, like you're going to get away with stupid choices more often than the stupid choices are going to come back to bite you. Yeah. So that kind of muddies the water because yeah, people do things that are pretty ill-advised and get away with it all the time. So we're just talking about increasing relative risk here. But yeah, so you very well may get away with hitting a one rep max and then jumping right into Smolov, but I wouldn't recommend it.
Yeah, I guess the way that I've noticed it is it really depends on how long you've been training for too, right? I mean, if you're not, you know, if you're not sort of training at a high level and you switch over to Smolov, you might not be outpacing your own body and your own growth. I mean, it's the same way that people start out squatting and start adding 5 pounds a week or 5 pounds every day they go in versus somebody who, you know, like Ray Williams, right? I mean, Ray Williams just broke the squat record at 1,052 pounds. I don't see him going into the gym and saying, I want to add 100 pounds before next year. Everything comes slower because of the greater increase in load on the body and the way that it beats them down.
I mean, he's added 50 pounds in like the last 5 months.
Did he really? See, yeah. Everything I say, you just throw it away. I got nothing. No, that's great though. I mean, I guess that maybe he will add 100 pounds. I don't know. I guess I tend to think that once you get over 1,000 pounds, maybe not. But hey, he came up pretty quick on that squat, so maybe he's got it in him.
Man, he is just absolutely a freak of nature. So something people forget about Ray Williams, he hasn't been powerlifting that long. His second meet he ever did, which was pretty soon after his first meet, was the Alabama State Championships in 2013. So 4 years ago, almost exactly 4 years ago. And at that meet, he squatted 905, but being his second meet and not having like any experience competing, he like stood up with it and then took a step to rack it before getting the rack command, so it didn't count. But, like, you know, super new lifter breaking what was, or would have broken what was at that time the world record for squat without knee wraps. So that was, and obviously he'd been lifting weights prior. Like, it's not like he just walked off the street and did that 2 months later, but he hasn't been in powerlifting for that long. And yeah. If I'm remembering correctly, the way he trained for that meet is, I remember reading an interview where he said, like, the bar at his gym could only hold 750 pounds only. And so how he trained for that meet is basically, like, I think he'd come from a football background or something and could already squat 750. And so just kind of progressed linearly from a 750 squat to 750 for 10. And then decided, like, oh, once I can squat 750 for 10, I should do a powerlifting meet. And
that's my plan. Absolutely.
Yeah. So, yeah, no, he's just a freak of nature. And I don't think he's close to his limit yet. Like, I think I don't know. I don't want to put, like, an absolute number on what I think Ray is going to hit. But 1,000 pounds for him is not the same as 1,000 pounds for pretty much any other human on earth.
Yeah, he is. I met him at the Arnold, but I also saw that meet you're talking about, the video from it 4 years ago. It's right about the time that I got into powerlifting myself, which always makes me feel good that I'm nowhere near. I'm about half of what he is, I guess. but yeah, I mean, it is interesting to see how much he's pushed the envelope in those 4 years. And it'll be exciting to see what he's able to do in the years to come. Definitely.
You know, Eddie Hall did that as well with the deadlift. When he deadlifted 465 kilos, which was, what, 1,036, something like that. You know, that broke the old world record. It looked like a hard lift. And then he just told everyone who would listen to him, next year I'm pulling 500 kilos. And yeah. Everyone was like, no, you just broke the world record. You're not going to add 77 pounds to your deadlift in a year. And he was like, watch me. And then he did. Yeah. And now he's talking about maybe trying to pull 550, which, why the heck not? Maybe he'll do it. Like, that's, I don't know. I think that, like, there are obviously physical limits somewhere, but I do think a lot of it is just people kind of like the Roger Bannister thing with the 4 minute mile. I think people kind of get hung up on specific numbers that they think are going to be hard, and that necessarily makes them hard. So using deadlift as an example, the first 900-pound deadlift at, like, a high-level national meet was Doyle Kennedy in the 90s, I think, like 92, 93, something like that. And the record just kind of stayed there for around a decade. Everyone kind of thought, you know, you get over 800 pounds, human beings just can't deadlift very much more than that. And then Andy Bolton and a young Benedict Magnuson, he was, you know, 19, 20, 21 years old at the time. They just took off and started trading the deadlift record back and forth and finally pushed it over 1,000 pounds after, you know, 3 or 4 years of trading the deadlift record back and forth. And now, if you look at, like, super high level heavyweight strongman, and 1,000-pound deadlift is almost like the price of entry now. Eddie has done way more than that. Brian Shaw pulls more than that now. Some of Hapthor Bjornsson's training videos look like he's probably at or around 1,000-pound deadlift. Hollins has gone well over 1,000 pounds now. Or not Hollins. Yeah, Hollins has as well. But I was thinking Jerry Pritchard. He's
yeah.
1,000 pounds. Like, that's just what people do now. After, you know, more than a decade of no one even sniffing 900 pounds again. So yeah, I think a lot of it is mental, and I think with social media becoming more prevalent, people aren't just like seeing numbers printed on a page anymore. They're able to see, you know, living, breathing human beings lifting these obscene amounts of weight. They're seeing the records increasing all the time. And I think there's just kind of been a shift in the lifting zeitgeist of, instead of people seeing these numbers and thinking about them and being like, oh, that has to be impossible, they're more so thinking now like, well, why not? Like, why shouldn't someone be able to do that? So I think, yeah, I don't know. As far as what Ray's going to squat in the near future, I have absolutely no idea, but I know it's going to be a lot.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Now, we spoke earlier about shoulders and lower backs and the injuries there. What would you say your worst injury was, and how did that affect you, and what did you do to fix it? How long did it take?
So the worst, in terms of like quantitatively, the worst thing that's ever happened to me, actually two. One of them was a really bad concussion. That was the thing that finally knocked me out of sports. And the other thing, a few years before that, is I had like the type of ankle fracture where you hear the snap, you don't realize how bad it is, you stand up and your foot's pointing the direction. So those were probably the two worst injuries I've had. They're completely in the rearview mirror now. I still have really limited dorsiflexion in that ankle, but that doesn't really affect me to a meaningful degree. Now, in terms of what's had the biggest impact on me, I tore my quadratus lumborum, which is just like a little muscle in your lower back that attaches like your bottom ribs to the top of your pelvis. And that still affects me. And that was 9 years ago, I think. And I think a lot of the issue with that is when I tore it, apparently just like no one ever hurts their QL. And so the physical therapist I went to, like I told him what happened. I told him where it hurt. And he was like, oh, no, it can't be that. That has to just be referred pain from somewhere else. So like he worked on my glute, he worked on like my hip flexors, something else. And never actually gave any attention to my QL or gave me like any stretches or exercises to do. And I was 16 at the time. Like I didn't know what I needed to do to start rehabbing it. So anyway, it didn't get any better. Went to another physical therapist, literally the exact same thing happened. It wasn't until like the third or fourth that I told him what happened, told him I thought it was my QL. And he was like, oh, okay, let's take a look. And at this point, it was like 9 months after the original injury, so there wasn't that much that could be done about it anyways. So yeah, that I still have some just general low back pain and like recurrent SI joint issues that I think are a result of that. So really all I can do is I don't really think I can fix it. But I know what I can do to manage it so it doesn't affect me all that much.
Now, do you roll around on a lacrosse ball or have you looked into much of the Donnie Thompson's body tempering with the heavy steel beam stuff?
Yeah, I'll do some light rolling. The thing that, and I'm glad Stu McGill has never seen me do this. The thing that honestly helps it the most is loaded spinal flexion. So if you know what a Jefferson curl is, it's essentially a deadlift with a really light load that instead of trying to minimize spinal flexion, you try to maximize spinal flexion. But like you're doing it with a low enough load that it's not going to like hurt anything. And since it's my right QL, I'll do Jefferson curls with like a kettlebell, lowering the weight towards my left foot and trying to rotate my pelvis to stretch that right side of my lower back. And that helps manage it pretty well. I still have a tendency to kind of shift towards that side. I think just as a way to like guard it. So with really high training volume, it can end up getting like really tight and fatigued, and I'll need to amend a few workouts to let it like relax and loosen up again from time to time. But yeah, that has helped a lot. And I think one of the things that has made it more of a headache than it needed to be is because when it happened, like I read spine rehab stuff and everyone was saying like, oh, don't flex your spine ever. So I never flexed my spine ever. And it just stayed tight. And once I started doing like spinal flexion work, like to loosen it up and strengthen those muscles, it's nowhere close to 100%, but it's much, much, much better and more manageable than it was.
What would you say? Are there any supplements you take or accessories you use other than just the big three for lifting? So it's two questions. Let's start with the first one. Do you take any supplements for your training as far as like protein or any of that stuff?
You know, I should. I have a lot, but I just forget to take them more often than not. I should be more consistent with that. At the very least, I should take creatine, but I just forget to take that as well. So I take a product from Citadel Nutrition called Athlete Vitamin, mainly just for the magnesium. It has magnesium in a highly bioavailable form, and it tastes pretty decent. So I do use that consistently. And I take melatonin to help with sleep. Other than that, there's a list of supplements that I mean to take consistently, but probably don't take often enough for them to actually have any effect.
I tried, I don't know what it was. I tried some, I guess, called a mineral pouch. I didn't know what I was getting myself into. Like, oh yeah, I'll try this. Man, I almost, that stuff almost ended up on the other side of the room. It tasted so bad. Like, it was like, yeah, it was really nasty. But I mean, it's supposed to be really good for you. So,
I mean, especially with minerals, they can just be so chalky as well.
Yeah. I remember I tried creatine in a powder form once, and I did not know that you're supposed to like mix that with like protein to get the flavor. Not so, you know, not so nasty. I don't know. Let's see here. Just going through this. Why? So here's a good question for you. Why the recent name change from Strength Theory to Stronger by Science?
For the exact reason of how you pronounced it, you said Strength Theory. It was String Theory. So it was a pun. If you'll go back and look at the old URL, if you can find one anywhere, there's not a double TH. And it's pronounced like String Theory, like physics. And, you know, it was a pun on like it's lifting weights, so it's Strength Theory, but it's also nerdy and sciencey, so String Theory. Anyway, no one got the pun. And I did not like the name Strength Theory at all, just because it's my business. I have to say it all the time. And if I had to constantly pronounce that double TH, I would slowly go insane. So String Theory didn't work because no one got the pun. I definitely wasn't going to make it Strength Theory. So it just needed a name change. And so I just kind of spent a day on GoDaddy, just typing in a bunch of different URLs just to see what was available. And Stronger by Science was the one I liked the most.
Nice. Now you've done some videos with Omar, right? You guys have done some of your squat and bench and deadlift videos.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and tell us a little bit about those, because I know those are available. The booklets and all that are available on your website.
What do you want to know?
Well, I guess if you just want to give our listeners just sort of an overview. I mean, they're all called like the how-to guides, right? You called it the definitive guide, the how-to deadlift, how-to squat. I mean, was there a certain audience you had in mind when you wrote these?
just kind of anyone that wants to get better at squatting, benching, or deadlifting, which I guess is kind of vague. But yeah, so they are kind of hard to get into when you first start reading them. I realize that because there's a reasonable amount of anatomy and biomechanics you need to understand before you can really understand what's going on with the lifts. So that's what all of the guides start with. And that's pretty dense and, quite frankly, pretty boring. But once you get through that, then it kind of proceeds from just information that would be useful and relevant for a beginner. So, you know, just general setup and execution of each lift. Then getting kind of more into advanced biomechanics for, you know, people who already know the lifts but want to understand them on a deeper level so they can troubleshoot and optimize their technique. And then the last part of each guide is kind of a FAQ of just common questions and issues people have about each lift. One of the things that we were very intentional about doing that I don't think people emphasize quite often enough with something like that was different ways to accomplish each lift. So if you look at how-to guides, you know, in books, other articles that are out there, like YouTube tutorial videos, people generally teach how to perform the lifts in like one specific way, which is fine for people who are built in such a way that that's like the optimal way for them to perform the lift, but isn't going to meet the needs of a lot of people. So that's something that I'm kind of sensitive to because my squat sucked so bad for so long because this is 2006, 2007. Raw powerlifting is just kind of becoming a thing. Geared lifting is still the big game in town, and everyone who competes in gear is all about West Side. And so West Side squatters, if you watch them lift, they all squat super, super wide. And so it just kind of became like a meme that wide, like if you compete in gear, you squat wide stance. If you compete raw, you must necessarily do everything completely oppositely from the way people do it in gear. That was just kind of an assumption people made. Therefore, you have to squat with a closer stance. And so when I got into lifting, everyone was like, oh, yeah, you don't compete in gear. You need to squat with a close stance. And so I tried to, and it just didn't work for me at all. And I think a lot of it goes back to that ankle injury I told you about. I have really limited dorsiflexion in my left ankle, so I just couldn't get hardly any forward knee travel. And I have relatively long femurs, so I couldn't hit depth with a close stance. And it just felt awkward and terrible. And then when I finally, you know, started kind of taking control of my own training for myself, I was like, you know what, screw it. I'm going to try a wider stance. And lo and behold, it felt amazing. So, you know, that's, I think these days things aren't quite like the orthodoxy isn't quite as rigid as it used to be. Just the powerlifting community was just so stupid back then, just speaking frankly. But yeah, that was something that hindered my development, I think. And I still see a fair amount of that. People teaching like one way and only one way to perform a lift, or saying like, you know, there are different variations you can do. But if you squat, you have to squat low bar with a moderate to wide stance and, you know, sitting back into it or whatever. Like, you know, they acknowledge that there are other ways to squat, but they say like, this is the best way to do it. And same thing with like bench or deadlift. And I think a lot of those are based on just like kind of common misunderstandings with biomechanics. So, and I realize I'm rambling, so I'll wrap this up pretty quick. But so for example, you see it all the time, people saying, like sumo deadlifts are cheating or they're like inherently easier than conventional deadlifts. So that comes from kind of two places. One is if you look at a sumo deadlift from the side versus a conventional deadlift from the side, you can get your hips closer to the bar of the sumo deadlift. So people assume that that's necessarily going to mean a sumo deadlift has lower total hip extensor demands than a conventional deadlift does. And the other thing they'll look at is range of motion. So obviously you don't have to pull the bar quite as far for a sumo deadlift. And so they'll look at those two things and be like, yeah, sumo deadlifts are inherently easier. So they're cheating. No one should conventional deadlift because it's hard and you're leaving pounds on the platform. So the two issues with that is one, yes, front to back, your hips are closer to the bar with a sumo deadlift than a conventional deadlift. But if you've taken more than like an introductory biomechanics class, you realize that that's not the view you need to calculate a hip joint moment. So not to get too much into the weeds here, but if you're looking at, say, hip extensor moment required to lift a particular load in a deadlift, you need to look not at the front to back plane, so the sagittal plane relative to the torso. You need to look at it relative to the bone being acted on, which is the femur. And in a conventional deadlift, the sagittal plane relative to the femur is basically identical to the sagittal plane relative to the torso because your knees are tracking basically straight ahead. That's not the case in a sumo deadlift with a wider stance and more hip abduction. So if you look at it, if you look at the lift from the side relative to the femur versus from the side relative to the bar, you see that the length of the femur front to back is the same, regardless of what style of deadlift you're doing. And research that has calculated the hip extensor demands in the sumo versus conventional deadlift bears that out. So there's a study by Escamilla looking at high-level powerlifters in competition that found the hip joint moments and moment arms for sumo and conventional deadlift were essentially identical. So that's one thing blown out of the water. The other thing is, you know, people assume range of motion is shorter, therefore the lift is necessarily going to be easier. But the kind of logical lapse there is you don't miss a lift because you were too weak through the entire range of motion. You miss a lift because you were too weak at one point in the lift. Whatever that weakest point is, if you can get the bar past that point, you're going to finish the lift. And so you obviously still have a sticking point in the sumo deadlift. Like it's not like a block pull where if you're weakest off the floor, suddenly you don't have to break the bar off the floor anymore. So yeah, you still have a sticking point in the sumo deadlift. So the shorter range of motion doesn't make it inherently easier either. So for a rep PR, it may, just because the total work required to complete each rep is going to be lower. So the like metabolic demands are going to be a little bit lower on a per rep basis with a given load. But in terms of one rep max, it doesn't provide an inherent advantage. Like it's going to primarily just depend on how you're built and how your hips are structured. So yeah, that's something that I harp on a lot in pretty much all of the guides. So I'll explain kind of on a biomechanical level what each technique tweak actually does on kind of like a more, you know, nitty-gritty biomechanical level. And then, you know, explain to people how they can troubleshoot their technique. And if they're having like a characteristic problem or they have like a characteristic weakness at some point in the lift, maybe technique changes that they could use to try to address that, or accessory exercises that could bring up whatever is limiting them there. But it doesn't present things in a kind of one size fits all manner.
Yeah.
Really long answer. That's why we did it. 'Cause people screwed up. People consistently screw up a lot of things with teaching the lifts, and they also present one way and only one best way to lift a bar, which doesn't apply to everyone.
Excellent. No, and I appreciate that about it, because as I was working through them and talking with other lifters, you know, one of the things I've noticed, even just with myself, is that my leverages tend to be somewhat different. And so I want to ask you just a couple of quick questions. And I, hopefully this doesn't take you doesn't take up too much of your time. But what one has to do with just sort of thinking about, you know, different age stages. You obviously train people of all different various, you know, ages and abilities and all of that. So, you know, thinking about older lifters and, you know, maybe somebody like me, who started lifting at 37, you know, I'm 41 now. I mean, what are there any particular things that older lifters should be taking into account versus a younger guy who goes in and begins training when they're kind of at the fresh point of their life?
So, okay. At 41, the, the kind of interesting things that happen with aging, interesting from like an academic perspective, haven't really started ramping up all that much for you yet. So at this point, something to maybe be cognizant of is a non-negligible amount of people your age are starting to get low testosterone levels. So that's something that maybe would benefit you more to get checked out than someone like me. Also just wear and tear of life. So if you look at, say, risk of osteoarthritis or disc degeneration or anything like that, all of those things just increase with time, regardless of what type of activity you're partaking in. So just simply by living 41 years on this planet, even though you weren't lifting weights for the first 37 of them, there very well could just be, you know, little degenerative changes that are already occurring with you, that may affect the way you need to train, the way you need to recover, you know, maybe technical adjustments to train around, a little issue like that. Honestly, with powerlifting, there's not that much of a cost of aging compared to other sports. So the two biggest things that really trying to think of how to word this. So, you know, if you look at, say, the NBA or NFL, you don't see many guys in their 40s competing at a high level still. Certainly not competing the same way that those same players were when they were in their late 20s, say. Mm-hmm. And two of the biggest reasons for that, one is just wear and tear of playing the sport. So playing professional sports is hard. Obviously, your body breaks down. Duh. Two other things, though, is one, reaction time, and also kind of reflex speed and just nerve conduction velocity. So that's going to affect how quickly people can react to stimuli and also how explosively they can move. And the other thing is the elastic qualities of your muscles. So you have a protein called elastin in your tendons that helps store energy and helps with elastic recoil. And that starts decreasing as well. So sports that are more reliant on like reaction time, like fine motor skills performed at high speed, or really, really high power outputs, which are most sports on the planet, those kind of fast, power-based, strength-related things start dropping off early. And I'm talking like your teens. So okay. In terms of like nerve conduction velocity and reaction time, the peak age for a professional gamer is like 19, 20 years old. Because by the time you get to like 23, 24, you're already old by like major league gaming standards because you just can't spam commands as fast as you could a few years ago. And that's, you know, if you're just like playing Call of Duty with your friends, that's probably not something that's going to make that big of a difference. But if a 18-year-old's reaction time is 1/100th of a second better than yours when you're 23, 24, you're not going to be able to compete at like a professional gaming level anymore. And so, you know, that just keeps decreasing with time and it kicks in. The time when it starts mattering is super early for like gaming, that starts mattering slightly later for, say, like football, basketball, anything like that. But eventually that does catch up with you. Hmm. And also the elasticity of the muscles affecting power output. That's one reason why you don't see all that many really old, well, not really old, but like late 30s or older weightlifters still competing at a really high level. If you put them under a squat bar, their squat one rep maxes may be as good or better than they were when they were younger, but they just can't produce as much power as they used to when they were younger. Their force output is still good. Their power output has dropped off.
Interesting.
So those are probably the biggest and most important just purely physiological changes that take place with aging. And luckily, they don't really affect powerlifting all that much. Like power outputs are super low in powerlifting, which is why it's not named correctly. It should be force lifting, if anything, but then it would sound like Star Wars. But yeah, power outputs are pretty low in powerlifting. And obviously, hopefully reaction time isn't playing that big of a deal. Maybe if you mess up a rep on bench and you're about to dump the bar on your face, you can kind of get out of the way quicker.
I would say the reaction time is probably more important for the spotters than it is necessarily for the. Well, one more question for me, and then we can wrap it up. Is like I said, I found you years ago and started following this program that you had written. And I know it wasn't a program, so I'm not like trying to put this on you, but it was about squatting and benching every day, kind of a daily squat thing. And at the time, my squat was stuck. I was at like 325 or something like that, and I just couldn't progress. Well, I jumped on the squat every day thing. I followed it to a T, and over time, my squat has pushed up to now 550. At 41, I feel like that's really good. Now the question I have though is, in the last 3 months, I have had the same adductor pop in the middle of a squat. Neither of the times was it like a maximal squat. It was always sort of working up. One was at 455 and one was at 315 actually. And so I guess my question for you is, because I don't have like a hugely wide squat, but I have a fairly wide squat. I guess from heel to heel, it's my feet are about 2 feet apart. And ever since my adductors recovered, I brought my stance into about 18 inches. And I really want to widen it because it puts a little bit of strain on my lower back to have it that narrow. But I'm worried about my adductor popping again. So is there any, have you dealt with kind of recurring injuries with the same adductor, or is there any advice you would give as far as that pull is concerned?
Now, don't be insulted, because this is like a really basic question, but yeah. What are you doing to warm up?
So warming up, I do some stretching, and my stretches have gotten progressively longer just as I've been training longer and need that. But, you know, I do some hip flexor stretching, and then I do some just sort of static squat holds as I'm warming up. And then I just jump right in with the bar. And at the time I was doing the bar 135, 225, 315, 365. And then once I got up over 405, I started to slow it down a little bit and work things a little bit, you know, in smaller increments.
Okay. So, I mean, something you could do is just spending a little bit more time warming up. And this may sound super, super basic. But even something as simple as doing maybe like 50 bodyweight squats before you even get under the bar, mm-hmm. That could help. Man, it would kind of depend on why your adductor was straining in the first place though.
Yeah.
But yeah, that would be the first place I'd look, just getting in a more thorough warm up, because something like that, unless you have just like major technique issues, and I'm honestly not even sure what sort of technique issues would cause adductor strains, except like going way, way wider than you're used to with really heavy loads, which that doesn't sound like what you're doing.
No.
But yeah, I think first place I would look is just doing a more thorough warm up. And that was the other thing I was going to say with age. So warm ups need to get a little bit more thorough. And also just recovery tends to slow down a little bit. which doesn't, that's like kind of an average difference between older people and younger people, but on a person by person basis, you don't really need to approach that all that differently either, because, you know, some young people recover super well and some don't at all. And same thing with older people. So maybe dropping frequency could help a little bit.
Yeah.
Not dropping back to like one time a week or anything like that. But maybe if you have, say, like 4 hard squat days a week now, maybe dropping that to 3 hard squat days a week and 1 more like recovery session where you're still getting under the bar and squatting, but not as heavy as you otherwise would. And also, yeah, just taking more time and doing a more thorough warm up.
Okay. No, I appreciate that. And that's helpful. You know, like I said, I mean, for me, I've sort of added the warm ups kind of along the way as I've, you know, so I tweak my back and I realize I have to sort of stretch that. And then I'd have other issues and I have to stretch that. I have to stretch my shoulders because of, you know, a shoulder issue. I have arthritis in one of my shoulders. So, you know, there's things like that, but it was this adductor thing just has me, I'm still trying to kind of get my mind around it. You know, what happened was I pulled it, I think the beginning of November, I took 4 weeks off and then came back after that to actually PR right before Christmas at 550 on my squat, which I felt great about. But then I went away for a vacation, came back, and I was taking a nice long time to kind of build my way back up. And within 2 weeks, I was pulling it again. And I just, you know, it was just a bit frustrating to have recovered, so I thought, and then have that happen again. But
I gotcha. Yeah, like I said, so the most basic warm-up possible that I recommend to everyone is just doing like 50 bodyweight squats before you even touch the bar. That sorts out so many issues. I find that for most people that works better than foam rolling or doing like specific stretches. It just gets the blood moving. And honestly, that is the biggest thing you're trying to accomplish with a warm-up. Like I think the word warm-up is too informative and people like overlook it. What you're looking to do is literally warm up your muscles. That is one going to just actually no. That's a really boring explanation that would put your podcast listeners to sleep. I'll just suffice it to say good stuff happens on like a cellular level when the temperature in the muscles themselves elevates, helps them contract a little bit better, use energy a little bit more efficiently, and helps with elasticity, and helping with elasticity helps prevent strength and pulls. So just something as basic as 50 bodyweight squats, that is going to get your heart rate up. It's going to get blood moving into those muscles. It's going to elevate the temperature in the muscles themselves. It's a really good general warm-up for squats that I recommend to almost everyone.
Excellent. Well, I'll try it next time I squat. That's excellent. Yeah.
All right.
Awesome. Well, Greg, we really appreciate you coming on and sharing a lot of your knowledge and wisdom with us. And just really appreciate everything you do. Just your site gets posted on the group a whole lot. And we just hope to have you on in a future episode if that's possible. We'll see.
Yeah, for sure. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me, guys.
Oh, all right, great. Thanks. Yeah.
When am I going to see you at Spider again?
So, yeah, it is on my to-do list. Every Thursday night that I've been in, I work about 20 minutes away from your gym, and every Thursday night I've been available to go down there. There's always been something that's come up. So it is on my – I got to show you my bench. I've been doing the bar path thing you showed on the Lifting Lyceum site. And it's feeling good. My first competition's in June, so I definitely need to come down a few times before the competition just to go through a few things. But using the cue for splitting the floor in the sumo deadlift, sort of engaging my legs has made a huge difference. And you said go heavier on the deadlift. I'm almost at 400 pounds on the sumo, and it's still not even heavy. Like I'm trying to progress slowly. And my coach, Jake Knowles, like, I'm trying to progress slowly, but I'm not quite sure how quickly I should be progressing. But
I gotcha.
You know what I mean? So, because I think when I the injury I had last year, I messed up my QL. I don't think I tore it. It was overall a misalignment of my spine, and it just really jacked up my back for a few months and weird stuff. And so I'm a little cautious about going crazy heavy with the sumo, but. We were talking, actually, Ever and I were talking about numbers to shoot for. And according to, I think RTS has a strength standard. And for me to be a class 3 lifter, I'd have to lift 1251 at 275 pounds. I'm almost at 275. And we'll see. That might be, I think that might still be a little conservative. I'm not sure. We'll see. But
I gotcha. Well, good luck, man.
Yeah.
Hope to see you around.
Yeah, no, I'll be back out there at Spider Strength. Everybody, you can catch Greg Knuckles at your site, StrongerByScience.com.
Yep.
Awesome. Oh, thank you so much, Greg, for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right.
Have a good one.
All right, see you.
Take care.
All right.
Bye. You guys can find us Facebook, Bacon Bibles Barbells. Just search for us on Facebook. And we are also on our website, BaconBiblesBarbells.com. And if you want to contact us, just go to our website and just search the contact. Should be right there on the site. We do have, hopefully going to have a few more guests coming up. Dr. Quinn Hennock with JTS. He's the founder of Clinical Athlete. He's supposed to be on next week, but he said he has to reschedule. So we'll see when we can get him on. And we're just currently also trying to get a t-shirt fundraiser up and going, and we'll see if we can get that started as well. So when all those things coming up, exciting times. Everett, we'll talk about your meet coming up. That might be a future episode soon enough.
Yeah. It's coming up real soon. Absolutely.
Awesome. Well, until that happens, gains and grace.
Gains and grace.